October 17th, 2016. We're in the home of Don and Jan O'Dowd in Santa Barbara, California. This is Jeannie Phillips. I'm a special assistant to the Chancellor at University of Alaska Fairbanks. And with me is Leslie McCartney. She's a curator of oral archives at Rasmussen Library, UAF. And we are thrilled and honored that you would take the time to do this interview with us.
Well, we are thrilled that you come all the way from Fairbanks to be with us.
Well, I've got several questions here, a lot of questions here, so just take your time and we can just have a conversation. The first question is probably the obvious. What attracted you to the University of Alaska president's position and to Alaska in general?
I haven't thought about that for a while. I was always intrigued by the North, by the Arctic, and by that whole part of the world from the time I was a child. I'm not a person who oriented toward the tropics. I was oriented toward the North.
But you've never been there.
No. But I grew up in New Hampshire, mm-hmm. which is northern oriented. Yes. I went to Dartmouth College, which has a historic tie to the Arctic. Has yes. been centers of Arctic studies at Dartmouth. Though I was not involved in that as a student, I was aware of it, and that was kind of an orientation. It's sort of the northernmost university in the East, and yes. not geographically, but in terms of its orientation. And so that was always something that made the North and Alaska intriguing. The University of Alaska I knew nothing about until I became a candidate for the position there.
How did you find out about the position?
Well, I was executive vice chancellor of the State University of New York, mm-hmm. and David Reisman, who in those days was one of the half dozen most important people in American higher education, was a good friend and a mentor. And I got a letter from him one day saying, I've nominated you for the position of president of the University of Alaska. Didn't ask me, he told me. And I didn't even know there was a opening at the University of Alaska. But I guess he had corresponded with Eddie Rasmussen.
Okay.
And Eddie had at Harvard, of course, went to Harvard.
Yes.
And David Reisman was a professor at Harvard. So they had a tie. And that's how, I guess, David Reisman got interested in the position. Then he nominated me. And we'd been in New York about 4.5 years at that time. And mm-hmm. New York is an interesting place, but very difficult from an academic point of view. Mm. And the reason for that is that the State University of New York, which is a big, it's 400,000 students, and we had a $10 billion budget, so it's a big enterprise. But the state regulation is just indescribable.
Okay.
How much the state involved itself in the operation of the university, which is truly frustrating. Such things as the university does not have, but this university, this size, 80,000 employees, does not have a purchasing office.
Oh.
All purchases are done by the state of New York.
Oh my goodness.
So there's some guy sitting in Albany who has to buy $10 billion worth of things every year. And when he gets around to your things, it may be the end of the year, or he may never get around to them, and the year is over.
Yes.
So it's the kind of place that was difficult. And when an opportunity came along, I thought I should look at it.
And constitutionally, the University of Alaska is more autonomous than most other state universities in the nation.
That appeal was
great
very
deal
strong.
More autonomous.
Yes. Jan, what did you feel when when he mentioned Fairbanks, Alaska.
Well, that was interesting because for some long time, I'm from the Northwest. I'm a native of the state of Washington, and I'd been angling to get back west. And I kept saying, you know, why we seem to drift back to the east and let's look at something else. Well, so that was, he sort of overshot a little bit.
A little too far west.
But actually, I think the day that he got that word that he was invited to go up there, I was out scraping ice off the windshield in Albany, New York. It was slippery and cold and miserable. And I said, oh, you know, it's probably not that bad. And I found that Fairbanks, once it got cold, it stayed cold. You didn't have ice around all the time to slip on. And there weren't puddles. And, you know, it was really better weather-wise than Albany, New York. So, and I was happy to go back to the West. And, you know, it's sort of in one's bones, I guess.
Yeah.
Were your children of age that they would come with you?
Or no, they were all grown up. Yeah.
What? How did they feel about this great adventure?
Actually, our daughter was going to graduate school at that point, and or making applications, and she said, you know, that looked good on my resume. My parents are in Fairbanks, Alaska. So, no, they were fine with it.
Okay.
Were there other people, Dr. O'Dowd, in competition with you for the position, or?
I think there were three or four candidates.
And they had that whole schedule. So, I mean, we were there for, what, six days?
5 days.
And we went to Nome, and we went to to Bethel.
Bethel, yeah. And Nome, and Bethel, Juneau. Did we get a Ketchikan? I don't remember.
Anyway, the word was that the last person standing at the end of the interview was going to get the job. So
we still kind of do it that way, to be truthful, to send candidates out to the rural sites.
Oh, I think
just
that's,
to
it's
see.
Important to know what that state is like.
Yes.
Yeah. What were your impressions of the communities when you went there?
Well, it's hard to remember, but they were fascinating places, different than places I've been previously. From Nome, we flew up to Kobuk and stopped at one of the really small rural communities, a couple of hundred people,
really?
Somewhere up, 150 miles up the river.
Oh, wow.
So it was a really exciting, an adventure, really.
Yeah. When you took over from Jay Barton, who was your predecessor, did you get to meet with him at all?
He had gone.
Yeah. What did you perceive as the challenges you were going to face at the University of Alaska at that point?
I guess arriving there, I didn't have any real idea of how the university was functioning, and I had met a few of the people. That's all. I figured out you learned that as you went along.
Yes.
So, and at that time, of course, the university was very well funded.
Yes.
It was. Oil money was flowing, and the budgets were, by comparison with, say, New York or Michigan, very generous. So,
well, that didn't last.
That was an attraction, I'll tell you.
As we know, about 1985-86, life changed for us up there.
A little bit, yes.
Just a little bit. What are your memories of that time? I mean, I know I was an employee. I started in 1981 when it was very generous, and then in about 86, 87, I think we didn't get another increase in our salaries for about 10 years after that.
That's
so it definitely changed. My memory of you is that you did an extraordinary job getting us through an incredible crisis. Can you share kind of what the strategies you used to get us through what turned out to be one of the toughest times for the university I won't say bar none, because I think right now we're probably in that worse situation. But yeah. But what was your process to get us through and get us to the other side of this huge
I'd just
crash?
Like to intercede and say that I think he was looking forward to using all of the things he had learned over the various places we had been.
Wonderful.
And he felt, I know how to do these things. I've done similar things. And so it was, I think that was important.
Oh, I agree.
As you remember, the oil price tanked and state funding began to go down.
Yes.
I saw it as, somebody said recently, never waste a crisis. I saw it as an opportunity to do some things that probably should have been done.
Yes.
Or put it this way, the university has expanded in ways that didn't make very much sense. They were more politically driven than they were programmatically or educationally driven. So it was a chance, I think, to remake the university mm-hmm. into a more rational enterprise
yes.
than it was at the time I got there, which you couldn't do in good times.
No.
You can't cut back people or programs or change direction in good times. You get so much resistance that it's not worth the effort. But in a period of crisis, you can do a lot. So what we did is assembled a small group of people. I can't remember now who all they were. But it was Wendy and Brian and Don Barrand.
Mm-hmm. Jerry Bamati, I know, was deeply involved.
Oh, yeah, he was... Yeah, I'm not sure he was in that working group. I can't remember who the people were as a group.
Yes.
And we met for several weeks trying to figure out what the options were and then put together a plan, which I announced on Halloween.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
at UAA mm-hmm. in their auditorium.
I remember specifically the amount of public forums, sessions.
Yeah.
I've seen the transcripts of those. I was glad that Julie Chavez was the Board of Regents officer then and not me, to be truthful, because they go on at length. But I really appreciated the fact that you involved so many constituents, not just the faculty, staff, and students of the university.
Yeah, public meetings.
But the public meetings that you held, I thought, really did help. So that community input, I'm quite sure, was very deliberate.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Edie Rohde had a big clock with a timer. She would time people and limit so they could only talk for 2 minutes or 3 minutes and bang, the clock would go off.
The Board of Regents office still uses one of those, as a matter of fact. Yes, it's a little more subtle than that, but yeah, ding, 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 your time is up.
Yeah, we use that to control those meetings, which went on and on. I can't remember, they were hours and hours.
Hours and hours.
Yeah, it was, and always some people who were deeply upset. Well, what we were doing is reducing, quote, local control, and that was the big issue. That particularly the community college communities just felt that they would no longer be in charge of their community college, which to a degree was true.
Yes,
and, but they got lots of advantages out of it by becoming associated with one of the three universities, they could get courses and they could get degrees that they couldn't have gotten otherwise.
But we couldn't be sure that it would work. This was all kind of sort of. We tried things and see if we went the right way.
My memory is that we didn't get too much pushback from the legislature. Do you remember what the government was saying about our efforts?
No, I agree. I don't think, for the most part, legislature was neutral on the thing.
I think Wendy was managing them.
Well, yeah, I'm sure Wendy and Brian were doing a lot of work.
And just for the record, Wendy, last name?
Wendy Redmond, who was our vice president for university relations, and Brian Rogers, who was at that time vice president for finance.
Yeah.
Right. Yes. So they were really talking with the legislatures and working that thing.
Oh, yeah. So that side of it was pretty well covered. It was more the communities were the...
Yes.
And the faculty and students and everybody in these several institutions. And, of course, the toughest was UAA, but...
The merging of ACC, with University of Alaska Anchorage, and my memory of that was the ugliest.
That was
transition.
Hard, and that was the most questionable of the mergers. But essentially, we could not have merged the other community colleges and left ACC standing separate. I think just programmatically and politically, that probably was not doable.
The buildings were right next to each other.
Yeah. But you know, we had, as I remember, we had three personnel offices in Anchorage. We had the UAA, the ACC, and the community colleges.
Yes.
So we had three different groups of people serving as personnel officers and three admissions groups, and that really didn't make a lot of sense.
No.
Or we couldn't afford it, that's the truth. We were no longer able to manage that.
So you were trying to amalgamate them all into one central...
We did in Anchorage, yes.
You held a unique position, or did something that no one else in our history did, and that is, for a while there, you were the UA president and the UAA chancellor. If I recall.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know how you survived that, just because the hours. Why did you make that decision to do that?
Marv Looney was the chancellor, who I had appointed at UAA, and he didn't work out. And there was a great deal of angst and troubles at UAA, and we were trying to bring together the ACC UAA faculty into one functioning unit, and that was not easy. But Don Behrend and I went down and decided that was the biggest job in the university to get that done.
Yes.
So I took over as acting president effectively, and Don as the vice president. And we spent 6 months doing that. Fortunately, we had wonderful faculty help.
Yes.
The faculty did not fight it. They figured out how to do it, and that was crucial. But it was technically just difficult to bring together two campuses, two curricula, two everything.
Two everything. And then you had, at that point, a union for the community college, ACCFT at that time, that had the bipartite faculty under them. And I don't believe that the tripartite faculty were unionized at that point. I think that came later, if my memory serves, but I remember many, many, many board meetings where ACCFT, that community college union representatives, were there and were not happy with the Board of Regents or the administration.
Well, I was not very happy with them.
So.
And so it was a standoff between me and the community college union. And it was not resolved when I left.
It was... resolved in the courts, if I recall.
Is that how
later
finally
on,
came
yes.
out? Yeah.
We were in litigation for a long time.
So that was a. But you know that, essentially, there are a handful of the leadership of the ACCFT, which was really involved, and the faculty, as far as I can make out, were pretty relaxed about the whole issue. It was leadership that was threatened. Their role was in jeopardy, and so they fought back. I don't blame them. I would have, too.
Did you then appoint Don Behrend, who was at that point in time the first vice president for academic affairs, and then you named him executive vice president? At that point, when it was obvious you couldn't do both full-time.
Well, I didn't.
Is that when you appointed Don Behrend as chancellor at UAA? Okay, that's what...
Yeah, I did that. What I did is consulted widely with faculty, students, trustees, community, alumni, leadership, and so on, and got a very high consensus on making that appointment without a search.
Yes.
Wow. And there, I argued we had to move on. We did not have time to spend half a year to a year looking for somebody. And he was very acceptable to so it was just great to have somebody who could take over that role.
What I remember about that is at that point in time, he was my boss, and I was not happy about that.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Because I know he was a terrific boss. He was a terrific man, and both he and his wife have passed on at this point in time.
Yes.
But I remember him well. He was a whistler. He whistled all the time. And you knew what his mood was by what he was whistling that day. And if it was if it was a somber tone, you knew that we were all in trouble. But he was a delight to work for.
Oh, yeah.
He really was.
And he loved Alaska.
He did. He did.
Jeannie, can you talk about what was his role in the university that gave him the experience to be nominated for a chancellor?
He was academic vice president of the system, really. And he'd come up from environmental science and forestry at the State University of New York, where I first met him prior to coming to Alaska.
Yeah, so, you recruited him.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And was a very good friend.
Just a lovely person to work for.
Really missed the two of them. Yeah.
Yes, very much so. Well, as you look back, it's been a while. But as you look back, if you could go back, you've already mentioned some of the decisions that needed to be made just because things were not making sense. But is there anything major that you would have done differently, looking back on what the aftermath of the what we now fondly call the restructuring?
Yeah. Well, it interests me that almost none of the changes we made have been reversed over the next 25 to 30 years. Lee Gorsuch was a very outspoken critic of all aspects of the restructuring. And he got to be
the chancellor at University of Alaska Anchorage.
And he made no changes along the lines that he said were great mistakes and we should never have done them. So I figured if he didn't make changes, those mistakes weren't too serious, because he could have.
He
was in a position to reverse a lot of the things that we did, and he didn't reverse a thing that I could make out.
No, I'm not recalling any either.
So I think, as I think back, for example, bringing together the ocean and fisheries. And,
yes.
No, that didn't work very well, but that was a personality problem, not a conceptual problem.
Yes.
And I know that the fisheries people and the oceanography people didn't cooperate very effectively, even though they're in the same college. But it still, it made no sense to have. We had four different fisheries, ocean groups. We had the one at Sitka, Juneau, UAF, and some other.
I think Kodiak.
Yeah. Whatever we had.
Yes.
We had too many separate units, all of which went their own direction, and we could not afford it, and it didn't make any sense.
Yes.
So we created one college, and I hope today it works together more effectively than it did for the next few years.
And they've been fairly successful. The new research vessel, Sikuliak, has increased our presence in the Arctic.
That is
a state-of-the-art ship, and it's been wonderful to see it in service. Talk about your role or your relationship with the Board of Regents. You know, that's always an interesting. You had some very powerful, very strong-minded regents that you worked for during your tenure, if memory serves. I believe Ed Rasmussen was one of them, Ann Parrish, another that I can remember, Ruth Burnett, was former mayor of Fairbanks.
Yeah.
You had some very strong personalities.
Tom McClotch, who ended up in federal prison.
Yes,
he was up here in Lompoc for
really?
Some years. I never did see Tom. I like Tom.
Yes, I remember that one. Unique individual.
Roy Hundorf.
Yeah. Herb Lang.
Yes, he was there. He was the chair when I went up there, but only for a year.
Okay.
He was gone after that. Excellent board. A pleasure to work with, I thought. It was really a good experience.
That's not always the case. So I always thought it was very, in such a terrifically hard time. You seem to be able to work very well with a very diverse board.
They were all good people. The guy from Juno, the lawyer.
Gordon Evans.
Gordon Evans, yes. Yeah. And also Don and Lois.
Don Abel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, he was a delight.
Yes.
Yeah. So that was a. I just had a very good board, and it was a lot of fun working with them.
And never any major conflicts.
Not really. Well, we had some problems. We had a student who, a student regent who got into a lot of trouble. Don't remember his name anyway. He was double billing on travel and generally. Got out of hand and he left.
Yeah.
But they were pretty open to all the restructuring?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. They were fully supportive. Without that, we couldn't have done it.
But there were changes in the latter years that weren't as... It wasn't as compatible a board.
No, the early board was exceptional. They were really on,
were cheerleaders and they wanted everything to work.
That was my memory too.
The Bill Sheffield board was. Mm-hmm. Whatever you think of Bill Sheffield, he could choose board members.
Was Susan Statham on the board when you were working there? Had she been appointed yet? I guess
she's a teacher.
Yes.
No, she was appointed by.
Steve Cooper.
By Steve, yeah.
Yeah, by Steve Cooper. I'm trying to think. When I first started working with the Board of Regents, who was Mark Helmerichs, I believe, was
yes,
on the
Mark,
board then
yeah.
as well.
And Mark was a very, very interesting guy.
Yes. I liked him.
Is he still in Alaska?
I believe so. So, yeah, just some really good... did you ever have any influence on appointments of the board? You know, sometimes a governor will allow us to at least suggest names, but do you remember ever being involved in board appointments?
I don't recall... Wendy would probably know that better than I. Yeah, but I don't remember being asked or playing any role in that, which is just as well.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, that can be a slippery slope.
Yeah, stay out of that if you possibly can.
So, who was governor at the time? Was it Steve Cooper?
Steve and Bill Sheffield. When I got there, and then Cooper. Those were the two governors. Yeah.
Well, is there anything that you feel that, as we went through restructuring, that really did not work? I think your point about none of the decisions were reversed is so well taken. I mean, it's so telling of its success. But if there was there something that you think, wow, that was probably ill-advised? I'm trying to think, too, and I'm not...
Yeah, even at the time, later, I don't remember anything that I thought we should have reversed or that something we might have done that we didn't do and so on. No, I think we had one shot, one opportunity to make as many changes as we could all at one time because you're going to get enormous pushback no matter... If we made one change or 20, we'd have had just about as much resistance. So we figured, let's try to fix everything that we can identify that could be better than it has been.
One thing that I noted that I thought was wonderful is that a subsequent president dealt with a lot of the funding cuts across the board. And, of course, everything weakens when you do across-the-board cuts. What I thought was extraordinary about your plan was the lateral cuts, which are much more difficult. They hurt a lot more. but getting rid of administrations rather than doing across the board. And I'm assuming that was very deliberate.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, we could, across the board wouldn't get us there. We came to the conclusion that the drop in funding was so dramatic that we just couldn't solve it by cutting everybody 15 or 20 or 30%. And in fact, we were prepared for a 50% decline in funding. That's what we were being threatened with at the time we made those decisions. It turned out the cuts were not that draconian.
Okay.
But we didn't know that, and so we had to make provision for what was being threatened, and people like Wendy said, yeah, I'm probably going to happen.
Yes.
So that was the reason for doing a large restructuring rather than something in between.
There are a couple of things now that we're in a funding crisis right now that are being brought up that are really what we would consider the sacred cows of the university. And athletics, intercollegiate athletics is one. KUAC is another one.
Yes, of course.
And then on the list for extensive review next year are the extended campuses and the extent to which they have the actual buildings and faculty there, instead of maybe e-learning units. I remember extended campuses being on the list for sure of things that you had contemplated maybe having to close during restructuring. I'm not sure I remember KUAC or athletics. Do you recall if those were ever on the?
We did. We tried. In Anchorage, I remember swimming and maybe something else was considered, and actually the campus recommended that, and we brought it to the board, and the parents arrived and the students arrived, and they moaned and groaned and complained, and the board backed down as they do everywhere in the country.
Yes,
when you target athletic programs. The students and the parents arrive, and the coaches and the boards, you can read it in 50 states, it seems like. The boards are, we can cut something else.
Seems to be what's happening at UA right now, as a matter of fact.
Well, that did happen to us. It was at UAA, and we had, I think, swimming and some other sport, which was targeted by the campus for a reduction, and it didn't happen. Which is okay.
And I don't think KUAC even came up.
No, I don't remember that at all.
But I believe it's an expensive function for a university. Generally, is not the case. I think we're one of the few universities that have that fund quite a bit of our public radio and TV stations. So at least you didn't have to do that.
No, I don't remember that as an issue at all. Yeah. That proposal I've been reading about of creating a single university, maybe that's possible. I can't imagine how you would do that.
Well, that does bring up a great point. Was that ever considered to go back? Because at that point in time, we had really only been three separate accreditations for about 10, 15 years.
I suppose that's right.
Was that ever contemplated to go back? It never was.
No,
okay.
Never. I don't remember ever talking about it, and I can't imagine how you would do it without creating so many auxiliary problems that you'd never get it untangled. You've got accreditation problems.
Yes.
But what would you have? One English department in three different places, three different cities, separated by hundreds of miles?
Yes.
Just maybe you could do that. I don't know how you'd do it. You could say we'll have English only in one, English department only in one place. That's pretty awkward for students.
Especially in the general education requirement courses.
Well, you could do that, have no department, just faculty in that field, but pretty hard to get good faculty to work in a setting where they have no where their department chairman is 1,000 miles away. That's not going to work very well.
Do you remember what was going on with our research units during these cuts? My memory was that they were relatively untouched.
Yeah, big grants.
To the extent that the rest of the university was.
I don't think we ever discussed any reduction in our commitment to research.
Okay.
And a lot of it was outside funding anyway.
Yes.
I assume they probably all had some reduction, percentage reductions in the support of the different research enterprise. Almost, remember at that time it was almost all at UAF.
Yes.
That was
pretty. It's still, most of it is at UAF.
Yeah,
still at
nothing
UAF.
At Juneau in the way of research, and relatively small, that then just beginning at in Anchorage, as I remember. So it was that UAF, essentially Arctic-oriented research, which is our specialty and ideally would not be reduced if at all possible. So, no, that was never under consideration.
Okay.
I moved WAMI to UAA, I think, at that time.
Yes.
Because Pat O'Rourke said he would just cut the WAMI budget. No, he would eliminate WAMI and use that money for other things. Mm-hmm. So I said, that's fine. We'll put it in Anchorage, and now you can't eliminate it.
It thrived.
And we disagreed. He and I disagreed on that, so I just moved it to Anchorage for Don Barron to deal with, and
yes,
that took care of that.
I was working in academic affairs at that time, and Nan Myers, who was the assistant provost, and I got to go into the bowels of the Arctic Research building where all of the WAMI equipment was, and literally load everything in there up in a van.
Oh, is that
when
right?
It was shipped down to Anchorage. Oh. I remember that very well. There were things in jars that I didn't know what it was.
What else? And the other thing that we agreed to disagree on was the extension. I can't remember. It was the military.
Okay.
You remember we had extension courses for military bases, and Pat wanted to cut those back sharply, and I moved that to Anchorage also to protect it, really. I thought we had an obligation that we had to keep.
And those still exist as well.
Yeah, I think those are valuable programs.
Yes.
What about the programs of the cooperative extension and the agricultural farm at the time?
There were some cutbacks there, but not very much. I think mostly in Anchorage, in that place out in
Palmer?
Yes. Palmer? The Matsu.
Yeah.
Agricultural farm, and that's greatly reduced.
Is it?
Yes.
Yeah, I suppose agricultural research in the Arctic is...
It's a tough go.
Yeah.
remember when I came, the is it rye? What were they growing out in?
Barley.
Barley out in the...
That's right. Yeah, we can just pause for now. You're back.
Well, during the restructuring, I remember a lot of angst about our community campuses, extended campuses, rural, very expensive, cost of living increases that we, or cost of living adjustments to those that live there are still very, very high. Kotzebue, I believe, is at 40%. Do you recall why the decision was made not to close them at that time? Because they are and still remain vulnerable when you talk about expense versus the rationale to keep them there. Was there a lot of discussion on closing those campuses?
I don't remember that there was. No, I don't think we were inclined to close them. We were inclined to figure out how to make them work more efficiently.
Okay.
They were all separately accredited, as I recall.
They were.
And if you're accredited, you've got to have a president and a vice president and a librarian and gosh knows all the...
Yes.
All those, and they had those people who were good people working hard, but we really didn't need all that overhead to serve 110 students or something in some of those campuses. They were so small. So the idea, how could we reduce the need for all this administrative overhead and continue to serve the people in those communities? And I think we succeeded pretty well in doing that. And the trade-off was to permit them to have advanced courses when desirable, or to be able to access such courses toward a degree.
Did we have a lot of pushback from our accreditation agency, Northwest Association, in allowing them to get rid of their accreditation and come under the wing of one of the three university?
I don't remember that as being a problem at all. We just did it. We didn't talk to the accreditation people.
Oh, okay.
We made the changes, and then after the fact said, here's what we've done. And as I remember, there was no objection or any challenge from them.
Because it's very unique. University of Alaska still is one of the most unique systems in the nation, in that we have, in essence, everything from a community campus to a PhD granting institution under one, rather than having it like here in California, where there's such a distinct community college system, very separate from your university system. So, but it seems to have worked. Whose idea was to do that? Was that part of one of your initial recommendations to put the community campuses under universities, or did that come from the community campuses? Because I remember that being very radical at the time.
No, that was our initiative to do that, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We didn't know how well it would work. It was really a bit of an experiment, but it was an experiment justified by economic exigencies.
Yeah.
And that's what we went to the accrediting people and said, look, we have this enormous reduction in funding. We got to solve the problem. This is the way we've done it. And they said, yeah, okay. I guess that's a good way as any.
And yes.
They never challenged it or raised any problems.
I think it made the community campuses stronger, in my own opinion. It seems to.
That was our hope. Yeah.
Yes. I think history is on your side on that one, for sure.
Well, good.
Jan, you lived through all this with him being gone half the time. What are your memories of this period in your lives?
Well, I say it was thoroughly enjoyable. It was different. It was something that was challenging, and the contrast with Albany, New York was so fantastic. I mean, that is an old, old community. And a newcomer is sort of thought of as a newcomer for at least a generation, you know. And you go to Alaska and they say, oh, we're so happy to have you, and we want you to like us. And it was great. What else can I say?
What were some of your hobbies and what were you doing while you were there? I remember you being very involved.
I was involved in a lot of activities and groups. For some reason, the wife of the president of always got to be a member of the League of Women Voters, and preferably the president if they would do so. I declined on that, but you know, the first thing I knew, I was heading up a committee on on roads and
that's right.
Oh my goodness.
And I can't remember the name of it now. Something I knew nothing about whatsoever.
The trail system?
The districts, the street districts, the road districts.
Like district associations that look after certain areas for roads.
The road service.
Anyway, that was the first thing I got involved in. One of my volunteer projects was, I went to the university press and said, you know, I've got time on my hands. Is there something I can do? And I ended up editing a book on Greenlandic language.
It was a
visiting professor who was a linguist, and they had to pick an exotic language. That was part of their program for the linguist PhD. And so he picked East Greenlandic.
Not West Greenlandic.
And he handed me this typewritten manuscript, an onion skin, and he typed from one edge to the other edge, single spaced. There was no, I had a new Mac classic computer, right? And that's when I said, okay, this all goes on the computer, and then I can work on it. And so I sort of gently rewrote some things, and I'd give it to him and say, is this okay? He said, oh, that's fine. Just go ahead, keep doing it. So anyway, I have that book. And it was, what he did was to translated many of the folk tales. There was nothing published in East Greenlandic, so they couldn't teach anything because they didn't have any books in the language. And so he was writing these stories. And
it was English on one side, East Greenlandic on the other side of the page, opposite.
Anyway,
page.
I got to the point that I thought, you know, I can really read this stuff, which I couldn't, but it, East Greenlandic, it is a northern language, but they do what the Germans do, run words, all their words that are listed this long, and they have all the K's and L's and B's and D's and anyway, so that was one thing I did.
You probably were in the University Women's Association.
I'll just pause this for a minute. Back on.
Okay. You needed a breath anyway, didn't you?
Well, University Women's Association, I remember you being involved in as well.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And, we had international diners and lots of different things we did. And Irene Payton was one of my very close friends. And they ended up here in
Seattle.
In the Seattle area. And so we kept in touch with them until they both died, but she was a great, great person.
Yes. Well, you worked with some incredible individuals, some real, from a historical viewpoint, in my opinion, some people that were pretty amazing at the university. And if you could share some memories of a couple of them, the one that comes to my mind immediately, of course, is Darlene Myers.
Oh, yeah.
Served as executive assistant to the president since started with Dr. Woods. And was retired in the middle of Mark Hamilton's tenure.
Oh, yes.
And could you share some memories about Darlene? She was the consummate professional, in my opinion. I'm scared to death of her, but can you share your memories of Darlene?
Well, of course, she was just a superb colleague in the office.
Everything was secure with her.
Oh,
you didn't ever
that.
Have to worry about anything going out the door with Darlene. She was wonderful.
And she was politically knowledgeable and would often offer a little advice.
Well, you don't want to do that.
Or, that's the perfect assistant.
Yes, and particularly when I first got there, I didn't know most of the people who were communicating with me, so she'd give me a little thumbnail sketch of somebody or what their sensitivities were or why they had some relation to the university. Never much, but usually well-chosen comments and observations. And she was just always a great colleague to have around. She was sick periodically, and must have been a real struggle for her. I know she She was not well a lot of the time. But, and Jerry, so we got to know both.
Yes.
Jerry and Darlene, and I appreciated both of them. And of course, don't have many, too many personal memories, but we...
She was very, she was a consummate professional, that was my opinion.
Yeah, I had great fortune throughout my whole administrative career of having great people in that role that I inherited in each case, or in one case, sort of inherited one of them, and they were all excellent. What a great era. There were people who today would not do that kind
of work. Letters went out that were free of error and free of...
Oh, if she would have written a book, you know she wouldn't, because she was that professional.
Well, of course.
Oh my goodness, but she... her title, she had a unique title. She was the only person at the university whose official title was confidential secretary to the president. It was a unique title bestowed only on her, and I thought it was so...
Perfect.
So perfect for her. When she retired, she had an old swing line stapler. You probably remember, she was a very delicately built, fragile-looking woman, but when she used that stapler, I don't know if you remember, pow! She never stapled. It was always this, and I inherited that stapler, and it is very dear to me.
So, okay. So what did Brian say, that she couldn't stand the email business, and any time that she had to have something done on the computer, she would then make a carbon copy and put it in a file.
She would print off three copies, one white, one yellow, and one pink.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, she did not take well to the modern technology age.
Her whole generation of people did not take well to that, as far as I could make out.
Well, she managed to do it all right, but then she backed it up with what she felt was much better.
Yes.
And I dictated everything. That was,
you did dictate.
Oh, yeah, that's all I never, everything was dictated. And so she would edit and improve on what I dictated, which was often imperfect, So I would get back, excellent version of whatever she got.
Again, that's the perfect secretary.
That was a great help. But I would read everything, and 99% of it would occasionally make a change, but very, very rarely.
Yes. Did you work with Sherman Carter?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
Another very unique...
Yeah, he was distinctive.
He was our vice president for finance for 10 years. What are your memories of working with Dr. Carter?
Well, Sherman, he was one of the toughest, meanest, and most effective people that I've ever worked with.
Yes.
And
Marine.
No, he was Army.
He did terrify me.
He was a colonel. He was terrifying. Yes, I understand that. but he was... He really could get the job done, and apparently when he came there, they desperately needed him.
They did.
And I really, as I've pointed out many times, from a president's point of view, you can have a lousy academic vice president, you can have a poor head of human relations, but you cannot get by with a poor business officer. If your business officer is not good, you've got troubles.
Yes.
And if he is good, you'll never... That's where you get in trouble. You get in trouble over money. You never get in trouble over people, even though they're doing rotten work. Nobody ever recognizes it. But if your finances are in trouble, then everybody's in trouble.
It seemed to me you had an extraordinary administration with Wendy Redmond as university relations, Don Barrand as academic affairs, and Sherman Carter as finance.
Then, and Brian Rogers.
Then after Dr. Carter resigned, and Brian was the budget director right before.
And then
really extraordinary.
And he was very good. We had Bill Kaufman. I went there when Astrid de Perry was and she was uniquely unqualified to be a university general counsel.
Yes.
So, and her departure was a great gain for the university. I don't know what Astrid's problems were. I think she just wasn't trained for the job.
Yes.
Well, you said that she dealt with the problems by just not doing anything, just letting him sit on her desk.
Somebody would have a contract that needed review, and 3 months later, the contract was still unreviewed.
Well, Bill Kaufman did an excellent job.
Yeah, and Bill took over after that. And Margaret Morehouse was replaced by... can't remember. No.
I will remember it, but it's not coming into my head either.
Can't get the name.
Yeah.
And he was very good. He had his problems, but at least he knew... He knew human relations very, very well and was good at it. Margaret Morehouse had been in that role.
Yes.
And Margaret was a hardworking and very dedicated person, but she'd never worked under a good HR person. And she went off to, I think, the University of Washington as an assistant, and said she learned a great deal. She should have been there before she was in that role.
Yes.
It just didn't work out. So when we finally got all that team together, it was a pretty good group.
A very good team.
Yeah.
You worked with some, we had mentioned them a little bit earlier, some incredible regents. I mean, who in their own right are going to go down in Alaska history as movers and shakers. The one that stands out to me the most would probably be Ed Rasmussen.
Yeah.
He could be very difficult to work with, but what was your relationship with him?
With Eddie, very good. I knew Elmer quite well and spent
his father
quite a bit of time with Elmer, and I think that that probably my relation with Elmer conditioned my relation with Ed. And Elmer was closer to my age than Ed was. But Eddie was very supportive and very helpful, and I never had any disagreements with him that I can remember. I know other people often seem to have problems with Ed, but I did not.
And you had a very sensible wife.
Oh, yes, and she was she is delightful.
Yes, she really is. Yeah. She really is.
We just take a moment.